Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Oh my gosh, I'm looking at the phones. Every single phone line full. That means we got lots of great conversation to come this hour with Dr. Carlo Broussard. We're talking about salvation. You want to talk about salvation? You want to talk about how salvation is presented in the Bible, how we are to understand our Christian salvation? 888-318-7884 is the number. Dr. Carlo Broussard, doctor of philosophy and a renowned apologist, longtime apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of a whole bunch of books, including one that's coming out, I would say, within days. Is that correct, within days?
Really, I don't know. Oh. I haven't chatted with Carrie yet to see what's the expected arrival date. I know they were hoping to have the book for the conference, but I haven't been informed as to whether or not that's going to play out like that.
But you can order it at shop.catholic.com.
Right. Yeah, it's called The Saints Pray for You, How Christians in Heaven Help Us Here on Earth. And so it's a defense of the Catholic belief and practice of the invocation and veneration of the saints. And so one of my previous books was Purgatory, like one of the number one search topics at Catholic.com. But I think arrival of that high-ranking search topic is the intercession of the saints. And even in my experience of talking with Protestants and converts who have come from Protestantism into Catholicism, the intercession of the saints is always one of those initial questions that's asked about. And so for us who have been doing apologetics for years, that seems like sort of an elementary old time kind of question. Nobody really cares about it. You're just beating a dead horse, right? Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it still weighs heavy on the hearts and minds of folks, especially for our Protestant brothers and sisters. And so that's why we decided to try to produce a book about it. And so we can have a resource to hand to people who call in at Catholic Answers Live and who we encounter in our speaking ministry and be able to give them that resource and say, hey, you want to know about the church's teaching on the intercession of the saints and answer all of those objections that arise from our Protestant brothers and sisters, then The Saints Pray for You is for you.
Check it out at shop.catholic.com. It's one of those doctrines of the church. I mean, I suppose there are a lot of them, but this one seems particularly like if you didn't believe it, you would want to believe it. I mean, like this is one where you're like, oh, there's millions of people who have gone before you in the faith who will pray for you and help you and assist you and be with you through this life. It's not, there's really nothing to like kind of be negative about. It's just, do you believe that it's true or not? That's what it comes down to.
That's right. It is definitely, the idea itself is definitely something that provides us comfort and consolation as believers. But obviously, we argue it's more than that. It's not just wish fulfillment, right, and trying to satisfy certain cravings that we have to comfort ourselves. We actually do believe it's real. And that reality, namely the communion that we have with the blessed in heaven and their continued exercise of charity in praying for us and helping us in our walk with the Lord, that provides us comfort. That provides us consolation because it is a beautiful reality that we can rejoice in and thank God for, because it is indeed a great gift. And so, like I said, more on that in my forthcoming book, The Saints Pray for You.
Let's go to Oklahoma then. John's in Oklahoma listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. John, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Broussard.
Okay, before I get into my question, Cy, the last time I called into the show, I told you I was going to pray for you that you got a raise. Did that prayer actually get answered?
Well, I will have to check my paycheck. I don't know. No one has informed me that has been answered. But you know what? You're like 2 minutes late. Chris Check was just here in the studio with us, stepped out, and now you do that. All right. Just keep, you know what, John? You just keep praying because it's a worthy cause, and you are a good man for praying.
Hey, Carlo, first I got to say, you know, your book, Meeting the Protestant Challenge, it's an awesome book. I'm in challenge number 9, and it's an easy read. It's not really really hard to read like some of like Bishop Barron's stuff is, and I am just loving what I've read so far.
Thank you, man.
And like I said, I'm in challenge number 9, so.
You're very kind.
My question is, and I kind of, you know, heard on like Facebook and some of the Catholic sites over there, my wife is waiting for an annulment from her previous marriage for us to be able to get married in the church. We have both have not been confirmed yet to the church. And I was wondering, are we to abstain from sexual relations until we're actually married in the church according to the Bible?
Yeah, John, I would answer yes, that you would want to abstain from marital relations, because as the church approaches these issues, because your wife attempted a previous union and professing those vows that assumingly captured the meaning of what we mean by marriage, namely a permanent union until death and exclusivity and all of that, we have to assume that that's a bond that God created. So given that assumption, we live our lives based on that assumption about what is real, which would involve your current wife that you're civilly united to is not free to engage in those type of behaviors, namely the marital act, with someone other than what we assume, namely her previous husband, the one she attempted to enter into a union with. So, given that assumed reality, there would be an invitation, there would be a call to relate to one another in a way that's befitting and consistent with that assumed reality, which would entail avoiding marital relations. Now, in this process of getting a quote-unquote annulment, which is a declaration of nullity, which in turn means the church declaring, and after investigation, declaring that the previous attempted union or marriage was never a valid marriage in the first place. It's not a declaration that the union that was once there is now dissolved. Rather, it's a declaration that there was only an attempt prior, and no union ever came into existence. In other words, God didn't join man and woman as husband and wife. And if the church makes that declaration, John, with that knowledge, then we would know what is real, namely, the one to whom you're civilly united with and married to right now would be free to enter into a real marriage with you, namely getting married in the church, and thereby engage in the marital act, because then she would be free to do so, to enter into that marriage, and with that marital union comes the appropriate behaviors befitting of that union. And so that's a summary of how the church would view your current situation, and given certain things happen with receiving the declaration of nullity, how your behavior would be moving forward after you and you're civilly united with wife right currently would enter into a real marriage in the eyes of the church. Is that helpful, John? Does that make sense? I know that's a hard pill to swallow, brother, and I know that's difficult, and I know that's a cross, man. And listen, yeah, I'm just going to be honest with you.
But it's not that bad. I mean, we've been married 12 years, so.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to be honest with you, brother, and like I have to articulate what I have come to know, what is the church's teaching and what is true, right? And sometimes right. That truth is kind of heavy to bear in our certain circumstances of our lives. But I do know this, bro, that if you and the one you're civilly united to right now will embrace that burden and that cross and offer it up to Jesus as an act of sacrifice, thereby an act of worship, thereby an act of love. I can promise you this, brother, that God will shower graces upon you and your wife right now and increase that holiness within you guys to give you the grace and the strength to bear the cross, but also to increase your holiness by bearing that cross, which contributes to the good of your salvation. And so here we have a classic case, John, where our Lord calls us sometimes to give up a physical good for a spiritual good, a higher good. And so know this, brother, I'll say a prayer for you, my friend, and lift y'all up so that y'all can, with faith and with courage and with strength, by God's grace, walk accordingly to God's design for human sexuality and marriage.
Awesome. All right. Well, I appreciate it. Now we know. And, you know, knowing is knowledge is awesome, especially in the Catholic faith and growing in the Catholic faith. So
amen. It is a gift. It is a gift. Yeah.
And yeah. And Carlo, Carlo, I need you to, you know, also pray for Cy that he gets that raise.
Yes, John, I like your attitude.
That's a good too.
Have you? Are there any of Carlo's books you don't have, or do you have them all? Can I send you one of Carlo's books?
No, I just have the one Protestant Challenge.
All right. Well, how about the response? We'll send you Meeting the Protestant Response.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, that's part awesome. Two, basically.
All right, John. Thanks. I got to go to a break. Right back with more about salvation. If you've got questions about salvation, the Bible, or all that stuff, baptism maybe, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884.
Your questions, Catholic Answers, live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers. I know for a fact that we have brothers and sisters who are not Catholic, who are not even believers in Jesus, who listen to Catholic radio because they're looking for something that's going to edify their souls. They're searching for truth, and they're not finding it in sports radio or political talk radio. They're finding it with Catholic radio.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Dr. Carlo Broussard is our guest. It feels new. You know, when it's so good, it just feels new. His podcast is Sunday Catholic Word. Check it out at sundaycatholicword.com. Each Thursday, a new episode drops, and it's about the Sunday Catholic Word, the word that's going to be proclaimed in the Catholic Church each Sunday. But he gives you a few days head start from an apologist's perspective. Chris Check put out a statement that said this. Chris Check is our president. Since 1979, Catholic Answers has led the way in Catholic apologetics, and now the same expertise, the same charity, the same joy that has informed our work for nearly 50 years is available to the entire Spanish-speaking world, and I do mean world. Our mission is nothing short of global. I could not be more proud of the superb staff at Catholic Answers for the daily yes they say to the Holy Spirit, for it is that yes that makes possible such an important initiative. He is talking about all the materials that are now available in Spanish. You've heard us talk a little bit before about Respuestas Católicas, that's Catholic Answers in Spanish. We've talked a little bit about the AI stuff. Now the entire website is available in Spanish. Just go to es.catholic.com or just go to catholic.com and go up to the little hamburger menu and check the Spanish one there. You also all kinds of AI generated materials materials that have been available to the English speaking world for a long time. Now, well translated and ready for the Spanish-speaking world. We're very, very happy about it. Onward and upward. Thanks to everybody who has supported us in order to have this joyful day come around. And check it out. If you speak Spanish or you know someone who speaks Spanish and could benefit from the website, es.catholic.com. All right, back
to... Si,
yes, sir.
I must say, I am very grateful for that Spanish ministry because this Cajun boy in Spanish just don't mix, man. I've tried to learn Spanish before, and my brain just doesn't click with languages.
That makes me, this is wrong of me, but that makes me so happy.
I sound great. I sound great speaking Spanish with that AI stuff, man. But in reality, this Cajun boy just ain't got it.
I'm kind of glad to know you have a shortcoming. I'm glad to know there is one. Let's go to Arizona, in Flagstaff, Arizona. Allegra, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Allegra, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Broussard.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. So I have a Protestant friend. She feels very comfortable coming to me with questions, which is so great. And so recently she asked me, it was rather long, so I'm going to try and cut it down. It's about marriage, kind of to follow up on the other gentleman's annulment question. So
yeah,
basically two questions. She believes every person you sleep with, you have spiritual ties with. Basically, that is what makes the two into one flesh. So basically she's like, well, if you've slept with a bunch of people, aren't you just committing adultery? So what's the point of getting married? The other question is, he believes it's not the church's job to judge a person's heart or for the church to decide if you're allowed to remarry if you've been divorced in the past. So obviously I'm going to bring up annulments and what that means with her, but just wanted to get your take on those two questions. Thank you.
Okay, fantastic, Allegra. All right, so with regard to the first question, I think this is a classic example, Allegra, of the need for an authoritative interpreter of the sacred text. Because in Matthew chapter 19, verse 5, excuse me, when our Lord gives the teaching about marriage and divorce and remarriage, he says, with regard to the question about divorce, in the beginning it was not so, particularly about divorce and remarriage. In the beginning it was not so, for a man leaves his father and mother, cleaves to his wife, and the two become one. Now, as your friend is reading that, she's interpreting that if you engage in the conjugal act, you actually become, quote unquote, married one with that person, such that, as she articulated, if you go and sleep with somebody else, well, then you're not fornicating, you're committing adultery. Now, notice that principle is there, is that the conjugal act is what makes the two bound together in what we call marriage. Now, that is not what we believe as Catholics. So we read that text and we have a totally different interpretation. And so, of course, that raises the legitimate question, how do we figure that out? Because on the surface, it seems as if that is the case, but most Christians don't believe that. And so how do we figure out the answer to that question? And so that just brings up the need of an authoritative interpreter of some things in the sacred text that may very well be confusing and hard to understand. Now, I think we can look to the text itself to disprove this notion that the conjugal act is what makes the two one. Because right after Jesus says that in verse 5, leave father and mother, cleave to his wife, the two become one, Jesus then says in verse 6, what therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. Notice that it is God who is the ultimate cause of the two becoming one in what we call marriage, namely a bond that no man can dissolve and must exist until death of one of the spouses. And so notice there, it's God who's joining, not the conjugal act that's bringing about the bond. And so I think we can look to the immediate context itself to disprove this notion. And so this, of course, as it relates to the declarations of nullity by the church, raises the question, in some cases, the question is, well, did God join together, even though the man and the woman engaged in the one flesh union, the conjugal act? And so the church comes in, and this is going to relate to the second question, and investigates whether there were things in the person's life, the person said, what the person believed, that would impede, call it an impediment, God from actually joining the two together. And this is not the church judging the hearts of people in an unjust way. It's not the church judging motivations without sufficient evidence and thereby being guilty of rash judgment. That would be judgmentalism, and that would be wrong. But Allegra, I can come to know what you're thinking, what your motivations for certain behaviors are, what your beliefs are, by asking you. And so the church is simply exercising a legitimate line of questioning in the investigation and saying to those two people who attempted marriage and saying, okay, when you were standing upon the altar at that time, what were you believing? What were you thinking? What were your motivations? And they might ask them a question like, let's say hypothetically that you would have believed, did you believe that once you got married, you didn't want to have any children whatsoever? And if the person says, well, yeah, that was my mindset, well, then that's manifestation of their thinking and their motivations, and that would be an impediment to a valid marriage. And so it's not the church rashly judging the motivations of those involved. Rather, it's the church using the evidence provided to them in the investigation in order to judge certain motivations and whether those motivations would cause to be an impediment for God actually joining the two together. And so those would be some ways in which I would begin to answer both of those questions, looking to the text itself of Matthew 19 and this issue of God joining the two together, not the conjugal act being the cause of the bond of marriage, and then, of course, with regard to the question about the church's judgment of hearts. What do you think of that, Allegra?
Thank you so much, and I'm going to just keep this and save this episode so I can refer back to it. So thank you so much.
Awesome.
Great, thank Allegra. You. Thanks. Thank you very much.
You had me scared there, man. There was silence. I thought y'all cut out for a second.
Because I was just sitting here waiting. I thought you and Allegra were still talking. And plus, John's praying for me to get a raise. I got to show what it's like when I'm not here a little bit. So I just decided I'd go on strike for 30 seconds.
Hey,
there,
man,
so,
yeah. that was a good cover out there, buddy.
Let's go to Kyle in Ohio, watching on YouTube. Kyle, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Bruce.
Hello, Cy Kellett, Dr. Broussard. It's a pleasure to speak with you gentlemen this evening.
You too, Kyle.
I am a disabled veteran, and I recently became an apologist. I did a speaking event at the local Veterans Administration recently and was challenged by a Protestant pastor on the woman from Revelation 12. My question would be, how would a more qualified apologist such as yourself tackle this question?
Yeah, so I actually address it in one of the chapters in my book, Meeting the Protestant Response. I have a chapter on Revelation 12, and I address several Protestant comebacks to our interpretation of that text as a reference to the Blessed Mother. And so this comeback is saying, hey, listen, the woman is a symbol of the people of Israel, not Mary. And so our response is to say, well, the issue is really not whether the woman symbolizes Israel. We actually believe this. We can believe this as Catholics, that the woman symbolizes the people of God. You have the bridal imagery of the woman, the crown of 12 stars on her head, and that calls to mind the depiction of Israel as the Lord's bride in the Old Testament in Ezekiel chapter 16 and Jeremiah chapter 3. You have labor pains that can be read as Israel giving birth to the Messiah. So we have no problem affirming that the woman is a symbol of Israel. However, what we do have a problem with and what we would challenge is that the woman is not a reference to Mary. And the reason why we would challenge that is because we affirm that scriptural images can have multiple layers of meaning and different reference. They can refer to different things. And so, for example, take the classic example of the rock upon which Christ builds his church. As Catholics, we say the primary referent for that image is Peter. But the Catechism of the Catholic Church in paragraph 424 affirms that the rock is also a referent to the confession of faith that Peter professed in Matthew 16:15 through 17 there. And so that's one example of where even the foundation metaphor itself, the rock in Matthew 16:18 referring to Peter or the confession of faith of the confession of Peter's faith. But also the foundation metaphor has a referent of Jesus in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 10. And so scriptural images can have multiple layers of meaning and reference. And so this is why we can affirm that it's a symbol of Israel and at the same time affirm that it's a reference to Mary. Now, that of course raises the question, Kyle, what are our reasons to affirm that it is a reference to Mary and thereby refute his notion that it's not a reference to Mary? And so as I point out in my book, I think a positive line of argumentation could be that, number one, notice that in the text, there are four characters. If you read the whole context there, there's the woman, the male child, the red dragon, and Michael, the archangel. Now, all Christians, both Catholic and Protestant alike, interpret three of those four characters as a reference to individuals. The male child, that's Jesus, to rule with a rod of iron, or a rod iron, iron of rod. The red dragon, John tells us himself, that's the serpent of old, that's the devil. And then Michael the archangel. And so consider this, Kyle, if three out of the four characters are individuals, of course all four would be, and that's Mary.
Okay,
that's
we'll be right back. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Is the Catholic faith still a rock amidst the waves of history? Why does it so often seem to be a mess? In his latest book, Confusion in the Kingdom, best-selling author Trent Horn helps you to get to the roots of the present chaos, explaining the destabilizing movements within Catholicism and exposing the harm and scandal progressive Catholicism has caused. Order your copy of Confusion in the Kingdom today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about salvation, and you're welcome to get in the queue, although I will tell you all the lines are full at the moment, 888-318-7884. We're talking with Kyle in Ohio, getting into apologetics. And Kyle, we cut off Carlo got the whole answer in, but then I had to cut to go to a break. So I wanted to check back in, and you were asking about how to deal with the lady in Revelation 12. Did Carlo's answer satisfy you?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, he was very similar to what I had said to the Protestant pastor, so it's very reassuring to know I'm in the right ballpark.
Very reassuring.
I would say real quick, I did have one veteran after the event reach out to me and say that he will be attending RCIA now.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
No, good for you,
so,
Kyle.
I mean,
God bless you, brother.
You
yeah, keep up the good work, my friend. Also, too, thank you for your service. You had mentioned you're a retired veteran, so we appreciate that. And keep up the good work in fighting for the Lord and defending the faith. And, yeah, so hopefully that line of argumentation worked or at least gave the Protestant pastor something to think about because there are positive reasons why we should think that the woman is Mary. And, you know, a second line of reasoning, just real quick, Kyle, would be, notice I said this earlier, I think, in the first hour of the broadcast. John is clearly describing the woman as the queen mother of the Messianic kingdom, because he's describing the male child not just as Jesus, but as Jesus the Messiah. Quoting Psalm 2, he's ruling with the rod of with the iron rod, and this woman is giving birth to this Messianic king. That would make the mother of the king the queen. And so this is the queen mother. That's the imagery, hence the crown of 12 stars upon her head, that John is highlighting. And given that John is highlighting for us the queenship of this mother of a Messianic king, that provides yet another positive reason to affirm that it is Mary in a primary sense. And of course, in a secondary sense, it can also refer to the people of Israel, because Mary, like we say, she's the icon of the church. She's also the icon of the people of Israel.
Kyle, since you're venturing into the apologetics field, maybe there's something we can add to your library. You know what? I think both of them, unless you have them already, I'd like to send you Carlo's books, Meeting the Protestant Challenge and Meeting the Protestant Response. I think there'll be a lot in there that will be helpful to you. I'll tell you what, I'm going to keep moving.
I would love to receive them.
All right. Well, all you got to do is hang on the line, but you might have to hang on for a minute. I just saw Edgar get up. I don't know what he's doing, but he's not at the phone at the moment. So hang on, Kyle. He'll get back and we'll send you those books. And it would be great to hear from you again as a fellow kind of laborer in the same vineyard. It'd be great to talk with you again. Alex is in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on one of my favoritely named Catholic radio stations, Ablaze Catholic Radio. Alex, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Broussard.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi there. So I'm coming from a Protestant background. And I was watching a Eastern Orthodox YouTube video, and the priest was saying how, you know, believers like in the Orthodox Church can achieve perfection in virtue. And I wanted to know if like the Catholic Church teaches something similar. And I guess I wanted to mention that this, if it is true that we can be like sinlessly perfect in this life, it kind of presents a big stumbling block for Protestants, because they, you know, that sinless perfection for them would come like, you know, in heaven in the glorification. So I was wondering if you could maybe answer that.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would answer the question as to what the church teaches about this or believes that we cannot achieve that absolute perfection and virtue on this side of the veil. For such perfection in charity will only come about at death, after this side of the veil, when we get on the other side. So, and so as far as evidence for that, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, Alex. I would have to go and do a little bit of research in order to provide some biblical and magisterial evidence for that. And so I apologize for that, of not being able to think of anything off the top of my head. But Here's sort of the theological analysis of that. We do believe that God's grace is powerful enough to bring about that perfection, but we also believe that in this order of providence, God has willed that on this side of the veil, even the justified, those who are in a right relationship with God, God will permit us at least to, in some way, shape, or form, fall into venial sin, which would be a lack of perfection in virtue. Sins that would not be serious enough to destroy charity in the soul. Now, that is a mystery as to why God would not will an order of providence to where he gives us those special graces that he gave to the Blessed Mother to move us to achieve that perfection and virtue on this side of the veil before death, but that he's going to allow the imperfect virtue and the failings of even the justified and the righteous on this side of the veil, as we're in this state of journeying toward our perfection at death and subsequently after, to where when we enter into the beatific vision. And so that would be the church's understanding, the Catholic Church's understanding of that particular question. Like, again, I would have to do a little bit more research to try to provide you some concrete evidence for that. So I will punt on that. But with regard to the answer itself, we would say that perfection and virtue will not be achieved until after death when we enter into the beatific vision. And even for the souls in purgatory, we believe that their charity is completed. That is to say, they can't grow in charity anymore. And even those souls in purgatory, they can no longer sin, but yet they're still imperfect because there's still some vestiges of sin that have to get purified, hence the need for the final purification. And so that absolute perfection will not be attained until we enter into the beatific vision.
Okay, Alex?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that.
All right.
You know, one biblical passage, if I may, Si, that comes to mind is in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, St. Paul, you know, articulates how for some, at least, those who built upon the foundation of Christ, they have works that are represented by wood, hay, and straw, and they're purified and burned up in the fire that is testing those works on the day of judgment. And so that would seem to indicate that you definitely have those who are justified, saved in Christ, and still not perfect yet. Now, let me retract this, okay? So I got to say this. This just occurred to me. It jogged my memory. So the church does teach that it is possible to achieve such a fervent degree of charity at the moment of death. This is paragraph 1472 of the Catechism, that one could die and thereby not have to undergo a final purification. So in that case, you would have someone achieving the perfection and the holiness necessary for heaven at the moment of death. Now, the church, according to my understanding, would not say that such a perfection and charity at the moment of death would be able to be achieved prior to that, such that the justified would be like, say, living a year in that perfection of charity and never falling or deviating from the divine law in some way, shape, or form, even with regard to venial sin. But with regard to achieving perfection at death, such that one could bypass final purification and enter immediately into the beatific vision, that is possible. So that's how I would articulate sort of these boundaries in answering that question. And hopefully that's clear enough, and I apologize for a little bit of the confusion that I inserted there.
All right. Well, Alex, thank you very much for the call. I'm going to just keep moving because I'm looking at lots of folks on the line still. Brandon's in Detroit, Michigan, listening on our app, the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome, Brandon. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Yeah, so in the case of, like, in the sense of, like, salvation, predestination, just understanding the nature of God, how do we reconcile that God is all good if he created, let's say, Satan, knowing that he was going to fall, or Adam and Eve, he created the tree of good and evil, knowing that they were going to eat of it? And I guess those are some examples in which he's creating things knowing that there is something evil coming about them.
Yeah. All right. So one line of response there, Brandon, would be to start with, would be the idea that we first have to get straight that whatever evil is part of this order of providence is not caused by God, but is permitted by God. And so, of course, that would raise the question, can God be all good and yet still permit evil? Well, traditionally, and I think this is right, we would answer yes, insofar as God wills to order or direct the permitted evil to some greater good. And we can know that philosophically because given that God is omnipotent, there is no good that he cannot bring about. To state it positively, God can bring about any good that he wants, given his omnipotence, and direct a permitted evil to that greater good. And so that would be the first question that we would ask. So we see that God's permission of evil doesn't count against his goodness. He can still be all good and will to permit some evils in this order of providence, and punishment be proportionate to that free abuse, that abuse of free will and that free rejection of him. and that punishment being hell. Okay, but this, of course, pushes the question back one step, which is what you're asking. Is it possible for God to be all good and create or will an order of providence where he's going to permit some to fall and engage in sinful behavior? I would answer yes. I think that God still can be all good and will an order of providence that's going to involve him permitting some evils. And here's one possible answer, which I think is sufficient, namely that the very existence, Brandon, of the devil himself, all of those spiritual beings who rejected God and or cohorts with the devil, and even the very existence of human beings that sin and fall, that is good. Insofar as these creatures exist, that existence is good, thereby a manifestation of the source of goodness, which is God himself. Secondly, consider this. The very action itself, whenever we engage in sin, Brandon, there's something positive there. I'm actually doing something, okay? I'm actually utilizing my will. I'm making a free choice. All of that positive stuff, philosophically we know, that's being caused by God. I can't do anything unless God is causing me to engage in that behavior, right? If God didn't cause me to use my free will, I wouldn't be using my free will. However, where the sin lies is my deviation from reason or God's design and law and voluntarily engaging the behavior with that disorder, okay, and not considering God's law for the human behavior. That sin, right, that evil in the behavior, that's something God permits. But the activity itself, Brandon, that the use of my free will and the choice that I'm making, that's God causing it. That's a good. And so that is a manifestation of the source of goodness, namely God himself. And so we can see here how you can have God, who is all good, will an order of providence where he's going to permit some evils, precisely because those very evils cannot be unless they're parasitic on or presupposing other good things that are manifesting God's goodness. And so with those two things in place, that first principle I articulated, it is not contrary to God's goodness to permit moral evil or sinful behavior. And then secondly, that with that permission of moral evil or sinful behavior, that's assuming other good things that God is causing and good things that manifest God's goodness. And so we can see how that would be reconcilable with our belief that God is all good. And so those would be at least two lines of response that we could begin articulating or constructing or explaining in order to reconcile our belief in God as all good and his not only his permission of moral evil, but his willing and order of providence where he will permit moral evil. And so that's how I would go about that in summary form.
And I will leave it there because it's break time. Right back with more questions about salvation. Our topic today, salvation, the Bible, and more with Dr. Carlo Broussard. Your call's welcome, 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul's Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
St. Hildegard of Bingen was a mystic, an abbess, a botanist, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Hildegard had her first visions at the age of three, which she called the shade of the living light. She later wrote about them in works declared by St. Bernard of Clairvaux to be from God. Pope Benedict XVI agreed when he named her only one of four Doctors of the Church who are women in 2012.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Carlo Broussard, our guest this hour, and we're talking about salvation. Check out Dr. Broussard's work every Thursday at Sunday Catholic Word. Go to SundayCatholicWord.com or wherever you get your podcasts and check it out. It'll prepare you for the Sunday readings from the perspective of a Catholic apologist. So lots and lots of great episodes there already, but many more to come because he's just a bit more than halfway through the three-year cycle. SundayCatholicWord.com. Let's go now to Jake in Indiana, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hello, Jake. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Broussard.
Hello, and thanks so much for taking my call.
Happy to.
My question is, My question is, hopefully I can get to it, and I just realized now it's Carlo, and he has a musician's background, but my main question was on saints.
Okay.
I just want a vision of, like, you know, when I pray, I see the heavenly host. There's obviously bodily saints, like the Blessed Virgin Mary and, the, I guess, Enoch and those who are translated into heaven. How does the church, do they recognize, like, you know, in Matthew at the end, it says many in the graves who were in the graves slept, that they arose after Christ's resurrection. Are there the church recognize those who are bodily there? Because Revelation does have, like, these 40,000 of those who are physically in heaven, or is that just imagery? And how does the church determine who is in heaven right now, that, you know, so we could be assured, we can pray, ask for their intercession? My second question was about music. I'm a musician, and it's like, how do you how'd you come from, like, being immersed in the as a musician and just, like, heard the call of God to become an evangelist or something, to do something in the realm of for the Lord's work?
And yeah,
all right, let's, because I struggle with that. Yeah.
Okay,
all right, Jake. All right, so with regard to your first question, brother, those saints in heaven who have their bodies, we know first because the Bible reveals it, like you mentioned, Enoch and Elijah. And then we would know about Our Lady given the dogma of Pope Pius XII and the dogmatic definition of Mary's bodily assumption. So we know for sure those saints have their bodies on account of those sources. With regard to all other saints, we would believe and affirm that only the souls of the saints are in heaven, awaiting for the final coming of our Lord, where there will be the bodily resurrection. So we can only affirm those saints having their glorified bodies on account of what has been revealed to us. Now, with regard to your question, how do we know that some saints are in heaven? Well, that's given by way of the infallible act of the Pope declaring someone to be in heaven with solemn canonization. Granted, the Pope is making that declaration after a reasonable investigation, where you have several, you know, multiple miracles attesting to that particular individual's intercessory prayer, and that provides the church reasonable evidence that the saint is in heaven. And then, of course, the church then moves forward to make an infallible declaration. It is an infallible act that this particular individual is in heaven. That's to say, the soul of the individual experiencing the blessed, the beatific vision, not that that person is in heaven in bodily form, like with regard to the Blessed Mother. So that's how I would answer those two theological questions. And with regard to the latter question about my former music career, bro, I just fell in love with Jesus, man. And what happened in my music background career, I encountered apologetics through the ministry of Tim Staples. I heard him give his conversion story, and my mind was attracted to apologetics, and I started studying theology and apologetics, and I fell in love with our Lord. I became convicted of the Christian faith and Catholicism in particular, and I wanted to pursue him in a relationship and live for him. And Jake, I came to discover and realize that the environments in which I was playing music was not suitable and befitting of a man of God and someone who was trying to pursue our Lord. And so that prompted me to make the decision to give up music because there was no way I could pursue that career unless I was playing in the nightclubs and in certain environments where there's immorality going on, and pursue my newfound love for theology and philosophy. So I gave up music and my pursuit of my musical career in Southern Louisiana and started my formal training in theology and philosophy. And here I am today talking to you, buddy.
All right, Jake.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Jake, I'll tell you what, I'd like to send you one of Carlo's books. I don't know which one to send. You got a book that you'd like to send, Jake, Carlo, which one?
Send him Prepare the Way.
All right, Prepare the Way.
First book.
Yeah, all right. Hang on. Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. It's on its way to you if you just give us an address to send it to. I am going to go to Clay on line two. Clay, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Broussard.
Thanks for taking the call. So my question is, since Catholics don't believe that we have like an absolute assurance of salvation, but we also have to receive the Eucharist in a state of grace, and we have to do so at least once a year, how do we get to the whatever level of certitude we're supposed to have to warrant receiving the Eucharist, and how do you establish that, and what kind of certitude is it? So how does that break down?
Man, Clay, that's an excellent question, brother. I've never considered it before. I love it, because you're putting together two beliefs in our Catholic faith that seemingly on the surface might be in conflict with one another. But I would argue that they're not, because just because we can't have an absolute certitude that we are in a state of grace, that doesn't mean we can't have a degree of certitude that we're in a state of grace, which would warrant reasonable belief and knowledge that I'm in a state of grace, and thereby approach Holy Communion in a worthy manner. So we call that in philosophy and theology, that lesser degree of certitude, we call it moral certainty, in contrast to absolute certitude. So for example, just to manifest the distinction there, I don't have absolute certitude that Cy cares about me.
Yes, you do, Carlo. Come on.
I cannot exclude beyond, you know, I cannot exclude in an absolute way doubt about Cy caring for me. But that doesn't mean I can't have some legit knowledge that Cy actually cares for me, not only as a colleague, but as a friend. And so that knowledge, that moral certainty that Cy cares about me as a friend, and he knows that I care about him, that's real knowledge. And so that would be sufficient. That kind of knowledge about me being in a state of grace would be sufficient to approach Holy Communion. Now, how do I know that Cy cares about me? Well, he provides certain signs. He speaks nicely to me, right? He doesn't tear me down. He doesn't say bad things about me. He doesn't kill me on the air like he does everybody else. Okay, but the point is that Cy has provided me reasonable evidence to justify my belief that he cares about me. So with regard to the state of grace, Clay, we can have reasonable signs or evidence that I'm in a state of grace. Like right now, Paul even said in 1 Corinthians 4:4, you know, I'm not aware of anything against my soul. I'm not aware of myself being guilty of mortal sin. I can't think of the fact that I've committed a mortal sin and whatever the time frame is. I'm loving Jesus. I really do love Jesus. I'm saying my prayers and I'm experiencing the love of Christ. And those are all signs, reasonable evidence for me to make that conclusion that I'm in a state of grace. The difference is, the gap is that I can't have that knowledge by way of the ways in which we can have that absolute certitude. And there's a variety of different ways we could articulate in virtue of which we can have absolute certitude, and those things just don't apply to my knowledge of being in a state of grace. So I can only have moral certainty, but I can't have that absolute certainty. And so that's what I would say, Clay, as to why, even though we don't have an absolute assurance that we're in a state of grace and only moral certainty, we can still approach Holy Communion in a worthy manner with a reasonable belief that we're in a state of grace.
Clay, thank you. What an excellent question. Thanks to everybody who called. If we didn't get to you, we'll do this again tomorrow. So we'd be happy to talk with you then. I'm glad that Carlo has a moral certainty that I care about him. I have a moral certainty that I care about you, Carlo. I'm not so sure about the other way, but I have a moral certainty. No, we're friends, Carlo.
Hopefully I've given you enough evidence that I care about your brother.
I have, evidence. I have reason for my hope, in other words. Check out Sunday Catholic Word. And also, if you'd like to have Carlo as a speaker wherever you are, he's happy to come. Just go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com, find his schedule, and see if he's available when you're looking for him. Carlo, thanks very much. Always enjoy
it. Thank you, Si. God bless you, brother.
You too. And that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.